welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're going to return to the statement that Paul wrote. It's beginning now of his second sentence in his first letter. The first letter Paul wrote was to the Galatians. And we have analyzed in fairly significant detail the first run-on sentence that he stated. Now we're moving to the second sentence, which begins in Galatians 1:6. It reveals some very interesting insights that are so often glossed over that we're going to consider. It reads, in a literal translation, "I marvel, I'm amazed and astonished that in this way, in this manner, quickly, you change. You desert and depart, becoming disloyal apostates, away from your calling in the name of grace to a different healing message and beneficial messenger." Galatians 1:6. Lots of things being conveyed here, and we need to consider all of them. You know, billions of people are currently suckered into this man's religion. Now, don't think for a second that the religion of Christianity is based upon the misnomer Jesus Christ. He was Torah observant. Christianity is Torah adverse. There isn't a single book in the Christian New Testament that he wrote. Yahusha, even if you knew his name, Christians. But half of your New Testament is comprised of letters this man wrote, Paul. Paul is the founder of the Christian religion. Of that, there is no informed, rational means of arguing with that. He is. There's nothing that Yahusha said and did that can be equated to Christianity. All comes from Paul's pen. I marvel. I'm astonished. I'm amazed. Are those of us who are inspired by Yahweh's testimony, who have read his portrayal of history, past, present, and future, who understand his perspective on his covenant, who understand the purpose of his Torah teaching, are we astonished? Are we left wondering and surprised when things happen? No, but Paul was. It's quite a confession. I know what's going to happen in Syria. I've told you. Because God told me. Because he told all of us. I know what's going to happen in Israel. Because God told us. I know what God thinks of Islam because he was unequivocal. I know what God thinks of Christianity because he told us. I know what God thinks of Judaism, that he despises Judaism just as much as he despises Christianity and Islam. He's clear. I'm also not surprised that 99% of the world's population disregard what God had to say. He told us they would. He told us that as few as thousands would avail themselves of his mercy by closely examining and carefully considering the terms and conditions of his covenant. He etched it in stone, as a matter of fact. It's the second statement of what is written on the first of those two tablets. Now, after telling us don't be religious, it tells us that it'll be thousands. Thousands amongst billions is one in a million. I'm not surprised. But Paul was. I marvel, I'm amazed, I'm astonished, wondering and surprised that in this way, quickly, you change, you desert, you depart, becoming disloyal apostates. Disloyal. Departing from whom? Changing. From what? Paul preached Pauline Christianity, a mix of Gnosticism, Roman Empire-ism, Babylonian theism. That's what he preached. Threw a lot of Dionysus in there, a lot of Greek philosophy. That's what he preached. He preached wholly and completely against the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. denounce them. And so he created a caricature, this Isu Christu, that was modeled in Paul's image. That's what he was preaching. And the moment he left, people said, that's absurd. This preposterous notion that this man claims that God not only called him and appointed him an apostle, but declared that the entire world, apart from the Jews, was his personal and private domain. That he had absolute and total lone control and influence over all of the world, apart from Jews. And that his message is to demean and to contradict the God he claims inspired him and authorized him in this way. It is the most ludicrous, the most preposterous, the most obnoxious, the most absolutely insane proposition ever purported on humankind that has been accepted. When you think of how absurd, how wholly and completely irrational Paul's claim is, as these people did, if you're informed, if you're thoughtful, you'll reject him just as quickly as they did. And that is consistent. Galatians says they rejected Paul because he's insane. His proposition is irrational. There is not one chance in a trillion, billion, gazillion that God authorized a man to undermine and negate everything he had said. Zero. Why bother with Yahusha if Paul's going to have exclusive rights over the world? Why bother with the disciples if Paul's letters are going to create a new religion? Why bother with the Torah, with the prophets, and with the Psalms if Paul's going to completely negate them and demean them? Yes, any informed and rational person is going to come to the immediate conclusion that Paul was absolutely insane and should not be trusted. That's what happened in Galatia. They knew him a lot better than we do today. But the difference is, and this is how we ended the program yesterday, it was actually much easier for them than it is for us today. I was played for a fool by this man for most of my life. And that's because you find his letters in a book that you're told is the inspired and inerrant word of God. You find everyone giving sermons devoted to this man's letters. You find that he is the most influential human who ever lived. And to recognize that such a person was insane, that was demon-possessed by his own admission, that was contradicting in every possible way and denouncing the very God that he said appointed him and inspired him, is very difficult in this culture, at this time, today. But it wasn't back then. Now, it's true. What Paul was saying in terms of his support of the spirit and of the flesh, which is Gnosticism, was popular with the Greek philosophy that permeated the Roman mindset. Would have appealed to them. And it's true that anti-Semitism, his hatred of the Torah, his hatred of Israel, his hatred of everything Hebrew, would have appealed to the Romans. And they were on the cusp of their two most savage wars against the province of Yehuda. And so, while what he was saying would appeal to their mindset, what he was saying was so utterly irrational, was so preposterous, that virtually everyone who heard him rejected him. This is a blanket indictment. The preponderance of the people that he preached to in Galatia rejected him, and they rejected him quickly and comprehensively. The same is true with Corinth. Read those letters. The same is true with Thessalonica. Read those two letters. The same is true at the end of his life. After he wrote the letter to the Romans, which we investigated the seventh chapter over these past few weeks, he wrote to Timothy and says, everyone has rejected me. Everyone has abandoned me. Yes, because that's the only possible informed and rational conclusion. There is no other informed and rational conclusion other than Paul was insane, that he was lying, that he was not whom he claimed to be. This is evidence of it. It screams out of his own admissions. I marvel, I'm amazed, I'm astonished, I'm wondering and surprised that in this way, quickly, you change, you desert, and you depart, becoming disloyal apostates. The next line, if you are informed, if you know who the charis represent, if you know that the charis became the gratia in Roman mythology, and that gratia was transliterated grace because of the influence of the Latin Vulgate, it should, if you are an informed, rational person, cause you to reject Christianity, should you have been a Christian. Away from your calling in the name of grace. Name of grace. Not in mercy. You know, there's a Hebrew word, one of Yahusha's most dearly loved disciples was named Yahuchanan. It means Yahweh is merciful. Kanen is the Hebrew word for mercy. There'd be nothing wrong with saying, away from the mercy that is provided by Yahweh through his covenant. That would have been totally appropriate. That's what the second statement that Yahichten Stone has to say. You know, we considered Paul's fictitious presentation of a commandment that says you shouldn't be a sexual pervert. There is no such statement that God made, much less a commandment. God did say that his mercy is afforded to those who closely examine and carefully consider, who observe his mitzvah, the terms and conditions of his covenant. If he had said that, he'd have been right. But that's not what he said. He said, in the name of grace. The confession, the philosophy, the religion that the Galatians abandoned once Paul left and said, no, we don't want to be part of that anymore, was a calling in the name of grace. Now, how do we get grace? Grace is a transliteration of the Latin word gratia. It's just a transliteration. Charis and the gratia is the same goddesses. They were the porn stars of ancient Roman Greece. Their naked forms are carved into the Acropolis, and they're painted onto the walls of the most famous Roman homes and villas. They are the source of bisexual lasciviousness. They're always cavorting, almost always in unmarital, shameful, usually adulterous environments, as they're depicted in Roman and Greek mythology. And it's in their name that Paul was preaching. That was not in the name of Yahweh, in the name of the gratia, the graces, the charities. I'm telling you, man, why would anybody trust a man who was speaking in the name of charis, the pagan goddesses? You know, he admitted that he was a sexual pervert. In Romans 7, he says, you know, I'm a sexual pervert. It's just, it's thoroughly inundated who I am. And I blamed the fact he was a sexual pervert on the non-existent commandment in the Torah, based upon a fallacious argument that was utterly preposterous. But, you know, for sexual perverts, the charis or gratia, depending if you're Roman or Greek, they were the poster childs. They were your patron saints. And so this man who has acknowledged he's a sexual pervert is championing a religion that he's promoting in the name of these goddesses. The goddesses of merriment. To a different healing message. So there was a competitive message out there. You know, the only competitors of Paul? Paul only had a very finite group of people who were his competitors, who had a different message. You know who they were? Yaokanan, Matanyah, Jacob, Yosha's disciples, his brother, the disciple he most loved, and the disciple who was the most passionate, Shimon Kephesh, known as Peter, Yaokanan, known as John, and Jacob, known as James. Those were his competitors. That's the other healing and beneficial message that was being promoted. He was in competition with them. Imagine that. Yosha picks 12 men to spend 3 years with, to lead by example, to teach, to prepare. And Paul comes out of nowhere, a former rabbi. And he's in competition with those that Yosha not only picked but trained. And people choose to believe Paul over them. This very letter will condemn Shimon Kephesh. Condemn him. And in other letters, he condemns Yaokanan, as he even mentions Yaokanan negatively in this letter. We have a serious problem. It's so easy to see who the fraud is. When there is this overt disagreement, it doesn't take a genius to figure out who's telling the truth. Now, it's hard to imagine a letter getting any worse, but that is the case here. There are five serious problems associated with the opening portion of Paul's second sentence. First, God's spokespeople, his spokesmen and women, know. They do not wonder. Yahweh's prophets are aware of what's going to happen. They are not surprised. Second, the benefits of Yahweh's teaching and guidance endure. Those exposed to his Torah, those who understand the benefits of his covenant, those who act upon Yahweh's guidance don't go astray. They are transformed by his instruction, and not for a moment, forever. If I encounter somebody who's open-minded, and I can explain to them that Torah means teaching and guidance, not law, and that the entire purpose of the Torah is to guide us to the covenant, and that I can say the covenant is the only reason the universe exists, and that there are five terms and conditions for participating in the covenant, all of which are to our benefit, and there's five benefits of the covenant, all of which are enabled by the first four of Yahweh's called out meetings. And you can explain that. And somebody is open-minded, and they listen to that, and they understand that Yahweh wants to be known as Father. At that point, their whole world is transformed, and forever. I want to be absolutely clear. I have had the opportunity to talk with, usually by email, sometimes by telephone, with about 1,000 people, like the gentleman who has just called in, who have been exposed, not to my teaching, because I don't have any, to Yahweh's teaching, to his words. And not a single one of those individuals has gone from considering Yahweh's words to saying, you know, I'm just not going there. I'm going to reject it. Never once. Kirk, welcome to the program. You, how would you respond to the idea that have you ever seen a case where someone who was presented the Torah, particularly as it presents the covenant, and came to know Yahweh and what he was offering through his seven invitations each year? Have you ever experienced anyone who then received that message, who then said, nah, that's rubbish. I'm gonna go back to being religious?
Not when it's presented correctly. You know, it's when it's, unless you're reading some strange translations where it's law and everything, then you might turn off, but you couldn't possibly read it in true context and say, no, that's not for me. You should say, yeah, I'm with you. Let's go.
Oh, I would go one step further. I'm not just saying there's a lot of people that read the King James Bible and probably read the book of Genesis that don't accept what God had to say. I'm sure there's lots of people like that. But when, as you said, when somebody goes to the point where I understand this, I'm going to accept it. So this is someone who has accepted Paul's message, he claims, and now has turned on him. They've become an apostate. That means they accepted what Paul said and now are rejecting it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you even think it's possible that someone can accept, embrace Yahweh's covenant through his Torah and then later reject it?
Well, I suppose it could happen. It's hard to fathom.
It's hard to fathom.
Yeah.
And to happen in mass, where the entire community goes from accepting to rejecting?
No, that doesn't compute at all.
No. I mean, my experience is the same as your experience. Just everything makes sense. Everything God says makes sense. It's just that every word adds to the credibility. And after a while, it's such a credible story. It's such a wonderful story. It's such a marvelous offer. It's so beautifully presented and laid out that with each additional word, you fall ever more in love with the author and ever more comfortable with the message.
Yes, sir. And it's kind of like fill in the blank. Everything you were looking for, wow, there, he did say that. You know, that's
yes.
Than going to church. I mean, you actually can read, and he says, he answers all your questions. He really, really answers all your questions.
Yes. It does. And when you, if you go out and say, you know, I don't understand a certain thing, you have a conflict. Like, for example, I had a conflict on the fourth day. You know, the atheists always make it a big deal that plants were created on the third day. The sun was created on the fourth day. That's impossible. And so you say, all right, I'm going to go tackle this. And what happens every time you tackle one of the tough issues, what you find is a revelation of profound truth. And you know, in that particular case, for example, what you find is that God didn't say that he created the sun on the fourth day. He said that the light of the sun became visible as a sign on the fourth day. And you then realize that, yeah, that was the process of the animals and the producing oxygen. The atmosphere began to become clear and therefore translucent and then transparent, and the asteroid impact diminished, as did volcanic eruptions, and the sun and the moon now were visible, and they became signs of the greater and the lesser light that would influence the fourth millennium of human history. And yeah. You go from objection to profound confirmation.
Right. And then you throw in the archaeology that's come along, that we're living in a wonderful time, other than all the other
right.
stuff that's going on.
Yes.
And you have the archaeology, and you have like, how did the lizards grow so big to be dinosaurs? And maybe it's a canopy theory, and on and on, you know. And so you have it's an atmosphere that's conducive for them to grow.
Right.
So, I mean, it's not like it's mystery of these weird things and
no.
You don't have to go to aliens and everything else.
Yeah, you know, in fact, you know, one of the things that, that you know, the creationists have so much trouble with is the dinosaurs, because you can't have dinosaurs with a 6,000-year-old Earth. And yet, Yahweh actually uses the term dinosaur. He uses the term mighty reptile. You know, and so, you know, it's this idea that creation is in conflict with the Big Bang theory. Well, Yahweh actually used the term Big Bang in his creation account. You know, it's just, come on, folks, you know, wake up. One of the great example was when I came to realize that the notion that there was water above the highest mountains on the earth and that covered the entire earth, that's preposterous. It's impossible. And so you say, all right, how in the world am I going to deal with then a flood that the religious position is the entire earth was flooded above the tops of the highest mountains, which would be to 29,000 feet, enough water on the planet to make that possible.
Yeah.
And the impossible is proof that something's not true. And then you read the actual story, and all it says is that there was an upwelling of seed water, which is the Berkel Impact Crater, created this massive tsunami, rolled through the region, that the land specifically that Yahweh was talking about. We have absolute proof that it happened when God said it happened, all the way up to the Black Sea, which went from fresh to saline at this time and buried those civilizations that were around the Black Sea, which is where God was focused on the people that were acting badly with an asama or conscience. And we find that those civilizations are buried by 500 feet of water. Instantly, right when he said, and you're saying, okay, now an objection turns into a marvelous affirmation.
Yeah, well, you see how quick the tsunami in Asia hit India and all. It didn't take very long, did it? And it was just a small earthquake compared to a...
Right. Yeah, and there's a huge difference between an earthquake-based tsunami and the consequence of having a meteorite asteroid impact the Earth that is so large it can leave below tens of thousands of feet of water a crater that's 25 miles in diameter. The amount of debris that is thrown up into the air by an asteroid strike of that magnitude and the resulting rain that would fall and the debris in the air is massively different. And so, yeah, you're right. You compare how quickly things were wiped out by the earthquake, Richter scale earthquake in Japan.
Right.
And you compare that to what this would have been, which would probably have been not a 10-foot wall of water or a 20-foot wall of water, but a 500-foot wall of water moving at the speed of sound,
yeah,
along with all of the debris and fallout and the rain that would have followed the asteroid strike.
Well, yeah, speed of sound. That's, you know, like we just finally got jets in my lifetime that went that fast, though.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's fast.
That's fast, yeah. And that's what's going to happen when Apophis in 2029, on April 13th in 2029, when it actually impacts the Earth. The likelihood is that there will be a tsunami of similar magnitude that will travel and impact coastal regions where most people live at about the same speed.
Can I ask you a quick little question,
sure,
Paul?
Sure.
Go back to Paul's time when he's preaching to these people, and he's
mm-hmm.
and not what we think of Christianity became, but he didn't offer anybody a relationship with a God. I mean, forget which God it is. It was no relationship offered as far as. You know,
he had a relationship with, you could have one in the name of grace. So there's one being with the cute girls, the cute naked girls. And Paul, you know, he said he had to be obeyed. So he was establishing a relation. If you consider, I am the divinely authorized dictator, and you will obey what I say. You know, that's a relationship of sorts.
A relationship with him, though.
Yeah, with him. Yeah, with him and with the graces. Okay. With God, not so much.
But he doesn't even offer, he doesn't even have a good holiday.
No, he doesn't. And he does not have a means to receive the benefit. I mean, there's only one relationship in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, the covenant. And he besmirches the covenant. He says that it enslaves. And so it says it's of the flesh. The only relationship that is presented by Yahweh and by Yahusha is the covenant. Paul annuls that. He has to create his own new one. And he doesn't have any basis for engaging in that relationship.
Yeah, that was the point. I mean, he really doesn't offer anything.
No.
So even if you followed him, you'd say, well, what's the gig, man?
What's the gig?
We have a holiday. I mean,
yeah, yes. Faith isn't a gig. You know, faith is not a gig.
That with a church.
Right. You and I can believe entirely different things based upon entirely different opinions. Faith is not a means to anything. You know, Yahweh is very explicit, as he ought to be. He says, here are the conditions for participating in the relationship. Here are the benefits of the relationship. And you can choose to ignore those conditions. But if you ignore the conditions, you don't get the benefits. If you can choose to embrace them, you can choose to reject them. But here they are. They're not going to change. And I'm going to prove that I authored this. And then it's your choice. That's a reasonable relationship proposal. You know, there's no such thing as a relationship. With the Terry, if you had proposed to Terry and said, listen, I want you to marry me entirely on faith. I'm not going to tell you what I expect. I'm not going to tell you what you can expect from me. This is unconditional. We're just going to go into it based upon faith on one another with no understandings and no limitations or expectations of any kind. What would she have told you?
Well, I can't tell you that on the radio.
Okay, yeah. It's preposterous. People, that's not the way relationships work. Yeah, my wife, she called me yesterday. My son's gonna, and his wife are going to our farm, in the east, and, he went to graduate school at UCLA. I went to USC. USC and UCLA are crosstown rivals. And my wife told me, you know, UCLA is going to play Virginia in this particular game, and they're going. And she thought it would be fun to get my son's wife, who's lovely, really bright, sweet girl, high character, that she was going to get her and my wife was going to pick up a UCLA jersey so they could all go together. They would match and go to the game. I said, you can't do that. You're married to an SC grad. That's a traitor. No, I was having fun. She is going to do it, and she can do it. But I mean, it's just a fun way of saying there are expectations when you go into a relationship. We'll return with Kirk and with Shattering Myths after the break. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Kirk, when you and Terry first encountered Yada Yah, and we're coming to know Yahweh based upon his own words, and that is yadayah.com is where that book is found.
Yes.
Was it difficult for you to let go of your Christian past, and particularly when you encountered questioning Paul, and Paul was presented as completely false? Was it difficult for you, or was it fairly straightforward? We have to go where the words lead. It's a choice of accepting the truth means rejecting the lie. Was that easy, or was that hard?
I thought it was quite easy. It was like our old preacher used to say, you throw down all these crooked sticks, and you throw a straight one down, you should be able to see it.
Yeah.
He and I would differ on who the straight stick is.
Yeah, that's right.
But it was embarrassing because when you do hear things that you know to be true, and I knew a lot of this stuff was true already about Christmas and Talmud and all that sort of thing, so I wasn't ignorant of everything. It was just you fall in these traditions and you're trying to find God and you go where you think you might find him. So, but once you're confronted with all this, I felt it quite easy, even freeing.
Yeah, it wasn't for me. I mean, it was freeing for me, but it wasn't easy. It was really hard for me.
You were pretty much, seriously involved in the church as opposed to just.
Yeah, I was seriously involved in the church, and I felt like that I was confronting aspects of the truth drip by drip, and each drip was eroding what I had previously been. And so it took a lot of time before that flood of drips finally eroded where I had been. And you know, each way along the way, I was always willing to accept the truth and reject the lie of religion and politics. But it was slow, and it was difficult for me. I am in a place now where it isn't slow and it isn't difficult and it's incredibly liberating and absolutely marvelous and every aspect of it is universally and overwhelmingly positive. But I was not like these folks that Paul is writing to, who immediately and quickly and totally rejected him.
Yeah.
It took me a good long while.
Message. By the time you got the message, it was a lot more polished than what he was doing. I mean,
oh, boy, that's true. Yeah, that's one of the things that's true.
That's not fair.
Yeah, it's true that the Pauline Christianity, when you read Paul's letters in an English translation, they have been gargantuanly altered to some degree to try to make it appear as if Paul was both literate and articulate. And then, second of all, you know, our whole culture revolves around Pauline Christianity. So it's stickier.
Having said that, the thing about Paul with me is I never could figure him out. I would read the stuff, and I'd even read it in the little Greek text, and I couldn't figure out how they got to what he said. because it's so confusing most of the time, and it didn't
right.
make a lot of sense even when you read it. After you could listen to a sermon all day and then go down and read it and say, how did he get to that?
How did he get to that?
And then you also have, I know, I went to a Baptist church one time, and it had Paul, and the sermon was Paul versus James, because they wouldn't pick on Peter as much as they would Paul's
right.
James'
right.
works, you know. And they would twist that around. I would say, well, if they're on the same team, why does it have to be Paul versus them? Why
right.
are they talking with the same voice? So that.
And if you're talking about Yosha's brother and a disciple for 3.5 years,
yeah.
How is it that anybody in their right mind would pick the guy who spent no time with him versus the guy that spent grew up with him and spent 3.5 years witnessing everything he said and did?
Yeah. So that was different on Paul. So when you were starting to figure out Paul, and I remember, you know, we would listen that, and then we would talk about it, and we couldn't figure. I personally, I was easy to reject him. I said, just toss him out. He's
right.
You know,
and when you do, everything fits together. I mean, you have to make no more circular reasoning, no more excuses, no more twisted arguments. You know, before you reject him, you've got to deal with the fact that he's saying that the Torah has been made obsolete, and you've got Yosha saying that the Torah is going to endure forever.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, it was really tough to try to reconcile those two, because they can't be reconciled.
No, By the time you go through about 10 points, now it's vital that you have such a well-documented research thing on Paul, and it's wonderful to hear, but you should be able to get through about the first 2 or 3 pages and be done with him.
You should.
Yeah.
Yeah, but, you know,
the
culture now is so sticky, it's so pervasive, and we've been so indoctrinated that it takes a lot now to convince a person, even when that person's open-minded. And so I would agree, it's overkill. Thank you, Kirk, for calling in. We'll be back with you tomorrow.